Okay, so we'll start then with the next session, which is one I don't think any of us would have predicted that we would be talking about when we had our joint meeting last year, accounting in a pandemic. With that, I believe I'm handing over to Neely.
Yes, thank you, Sue. And yes, COVID-19, the topic that I wish we could stop talking about. Our plan for this session is to have each of our respective teams give you an update and overview of the strategy that both of the boards are using to deal with the COVID-19 issues that are arising. And you'll find as the teams talk that they're actually quite similar in approach, and then also take you through a little bit of the issues that we're encountering on COVID-19 over the last few months. And then we'll open the floor to you to go over any sorts of questions you might have for us or for each other, and then to also share some of the feedback that you're hearing from stakeholders and in your outreach. So with that, Anuj, I will turn things over to you.
Thank you, Neely. I hope everybody can hear me. Okay, good morning and good afternoon, everyone. I'll present agenda paper 32A, discussing the IESB's response to the COVID-19 crisis. Hopefully you have had a chance to read the slide deck, so I'll just highlight a few points. As explained on slide 6, the IESB's strategy in responding to COVID-19 focuses on monitoring application challenges, responding to urgent issues, and continually engaging with its stakeholders. As noted on slide 7, the IESB has been monitoring application challenges to support stakeholders in their efforts to promote consistent application of IFRS standards in their respective jurisdictions. One key takeaway we have observed from our COVID-19 work is that while, of course, some reporting challenges have arisen in this environment, in general, feedback has indicated that IFRS standards are working well in practice. Slide 8 lists some application challenges that we are aware of. A second key takeaway is an observation that most of these challenges are not the result of a lack of clarity in the requirements in IFRS standards, but arise more because of the heightened economic uncertainties. The nature of the challenges encountered also varies between entities and jurisdictions, depending on their facts and circumstances. For example, we are aware that in this highly uncertain environment, entities often find it challenging to estimate items in their financial statements and make assumptions about the future. A panel discussion at the IFRS Foundation's recent conference and a related article published on our website highlights the need for entities to have a robust process and to provide transparent and relevant disclosures in these circumstances. I'll now move on to slide 9. The slide highlights our third key takeaway, that when necessary and appropriate, targeted, urgent action has been taken. In particular, the IESB issued an amendment to IFRS 16, providing optional practical relief for lessees in accounting for particular rent concession occurring as a result of direct consequence of the COVID-19 pandemic. In addition, we have published educational materials to help entities apply particular requirements in IFRS 9 and IFRS 16. Educational material on IFRS 9 explains the application of the expected credit loss model during these uncertain times. This material stresses the need for judgment and for estimates to be based on reasonable and supportable information. Before issuing the amendment to IFRS 16, the IESB also published an educational material on IFRS 16, highlighting relevant requirements for entities considering how to account for rent concessions. Slide 10 and 11 illustrates different ways in which the IESB has adjusted its work to ensure engagement with stakeholders during the crisis. For example, the IESB has resumed all its consultative group meetings, albeit virtually. In addition, the IESB has extended the comment period of some published consultation documents and has revised timelines for some forthcoming consultation documents. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're handing over to Hillary.
Yes, that's it. Thank you, Sue. And just to quickly introduce myself, I'm Hilary Salo. I joined the FASB as the technical director in late August, so I'm really pleased to be with you all here today. So I'll be speaking to slides that are included as agenda item 32B. And as was mentioned, you know, although the current environment is impacting entities around the globe really quite differently, I would say that the FASB's response and the ISB's response and key takeaways are really similar to what was just discussed. So, you know, I would say from the FASB's perspective, our main focus has really been during this time to support our stakeholders. So we had intentionally slowed our standard setting from March through July, and then really reprioritized our agenda to focus on staff Q&As, technical inquiries, as well as educational materials to really help address those emerging issues that were coming up from the current environment. And while we continue to be really thoughtful about the challenges that our stakeholders have on their plates, we were able to resume our regular cadence of board meetings, all virtually, in July, as well as we were able to issue certain documents that we had postponed from the spring, including certain exposure drafts related to practical expedience for private companies on how to measure the grant date fair value of equity classified share-based awards, as well as an exposure draft on our elements portion of our conceptual framework project. And as Chris Roberge had mentioned earlier, we were able to hold our postponed virtual leasing roundtable discussion in September. And that was really great because I think it was a great active discussion in a virtual environment, which I think was really great for all of us to be able to see. In addition, while we have resumed a pretty active standard setting agenda in the third and fourth quarter, including the issuance of multiple exposure drafts and final standards, we really do continue to be mindful of the length of comment periods. Really, we want to ensure that entities are able to thoughtfully evaluate the proposed guidance in an environment where they really do have significant competing demands. And we also continue to be focused on allocating staff resources to supporting our stakeholders on those current emerging issues. You know, when it relates to technical inquiries, we've had many inquiries come in related to leasing, interest income, fair value, hedging, a lot of the government programs and government assistance programs that have come out through the door because of COVID. And we're really working closely with AICPA staff, the SEC staff, you know, banking regulators here in the US, as well as other stakeholders when we're responding to these technical inquiries. In addition, we have issued certain staff Q&As. So we issued a staff Q&A related to the impact of misforecasted transactions due to COVID-19 on cash flow hedging relationships, as well as how to evaluate lease concessions provided by lessors related to the effects of COVID-19. And we've also heard from stakeholders the need for additional educational materials. So for example, we heard more from our private company council that certain entities are having to apply the accounting guidance for debt restructurings or modifications for either the first time or maybe just on a much more frequent basis than they've had to in the past. So we did recently post a FASB staff educational paper that provides stakeholders with a summary and an overview of the borrower's accounting for debt modifications and restructurings. It really provides a number of different examples to try and help illustrate that guidance, especially in the context of the current environment. Now, when it comes to effective dates, we're trying to be mindful of the impact that the current environment has on our stakeholders in really evaluating whether or not the effective dates of certain of our standards should be deferred to really help facilitate that high quality adoption of our standards. So in June of this year, we did allow a 1-year deferral of the effective dates related to revenue and leasing for certain private company and NFP stakeholders. As well, based on feedback that we received from our continued post-issuance outreach related to our insurance standard, we did recently issue a final ASU that provides a 1-year delay for public and non-public insurance entities, as we heard that those entities did need additional time to ensure that high quality adoption of the standard due to the impact of the pandemic. And I think you'll note on the slides, those were issued before, were due before we finalized that standard, so that 1-year deferral has now been finalized. Also, I think one of the good pieces of feedback we've heard from our stakeholders is, you know, really they're really thankful for the information that we've been providing, but sometimes it's hard for them to find that information. So we've even just taken the step of trying to make it easier for people to find that information on our website, right? We created a COVID-19 web portal, provides links to our Q&As and our educational materials, and really also provides a link to where they can submit their inquiries through our technical inquiry service. So I think that we've really tried to take in the feedback that we've been hearing from our advisory committees and really trying to, as much as possible, support stakeholders in this current environment. But as you can see, there's a lot of similarity between the approaches that the boards have taken. And, you know, and I think from the stakeholder perspective, we've heard good feedback related to the responsiveness of the staffs from both the ISB and the FASB.
Thank you very much. So I guess I open up now to see if anybody's got any comments or questions. Rich.
Thanks, Sue. I think as most people know, we do have a project on our agenda on disclosure related to government grants. But under US GAAP, we don't have specific accounting guidance. And there's certainly been a large volume of government assistance, both in the US and around the world. So I'm curious, a lot of the US entities do apply IAS-20 by analogy. I'm curious if you've gotten some feedback on how that standard has been holding up around the world with different forms of government assistance. Does it seem to be answering people's questions? Are you being asked for different clarification?
Yeah, maybe I can step in. So by way of introduction, I'm Javed. I'm a technical staff member at the ISB. So in terms of government grants, I think we have heard of some application challenges naturally, but I think like Anuj said, more of what we've heard have been more because of the uncertainty and how to reflect that when you're making judgments and coming up with best estimates rather than being particular application challenges for IS-20 itself. Now, having said that, of course, IS-20 is a standard that was written a number of years ago. So there, I'm not saying it's perfect or that there are no challenges about it at all, but at least what we've heard is more around the judgments and making estimates piece rather than about the standard itself. I'm not sure, Neely, if you want to add anything or any other board member wants to come in.
Let me just add one more thing. Rich, we're in the process of developing the board's agenda consultation for the 2022 to 2026 period. And as part of that, we had done some preliminary outreach. And one of the things we had heard is a desire by some for us to take another look at IS-20. And I think some of the issues there relate to the optionality in the standard and the inconsistency with how we're approaching new models and new standards compared to what we have in IS-20. So that is something that we'll probably hear more feedback on in the coming months, I think.
Thank you.
Anne.
Thanks, Sue. I wanted to ask someone from FASB about the relief that was offered to major banks in relation to CECL. Understand that there was a possible delay. A bank could elect to delay the effects into regulatory capital. But I also heard that many banks didn't do that. And I just wonder if you could update me on where that got to, you know, if banks were not taking that option, and what message you saw sent out to the community by the fact that major banks decided they didn't actually need the relief that Congress was offering them.
Tricky interactions, regulation, and isn't there? But who's going to respond, Hillary?
Sure, I can start, and certainly others can jump in. I mean, I think there's a couple of different pieces of the relief. Right, there was the relief related to the regulatory capital impact of CECL. I do think that many banks have taken that relief and have seen that as a benefit, but there was also a relief through the CARES Act that you could defer the application of CECL through the end of this year. And that's, I think, we've only had, I think it was only like 40 some banks took that ability to defer CECL through this year. And I think part of that is because when you have to apply CECL at the beginning of 2021, you're going to have to go back and do it as if you had adopted as of the beginning of this year. So for many banks, I think they didn't necessarily see the significant benefit for it, depending on where they were from an implementation perspective. But certainly it has caused certain questions, right, to come up as we're getting closer to the end of the year, you know, whether or not that could possibly, you know, continue to be delayed from through legislation, which is something that we continue to look through, because obviously that came through legislation, not obviously through the FASB. Not sure, Rich or Sue, if you guys have other comments related to that.
Yeah, I see Hal raising his hand, so he will be able to give you more details. But, it, you know, as Hillary mentioned, it wasn't a significant number of financial institutions, and actually the ones that took advantage of the relief under the CARES Act to not apply CECL were smaller financial institutions. So it was skewed on the lower end. Hal, did you want to add?
Yeah, I think, Rich, you were really making the point. We have a little bit different financial system here in the U.S. than we do in many other areas of the world. You know, there are over 10,000 institutions in the U.S. The standard really, the way we designed it, only applied to less than 2% of all those 10,000 in 2020. And of those, if you looked at the numbers, Hillary's right, there were 43 that took the option to not apply CECL, to defer it until the end of this year, December 31st. But if you looked at the size of the institutions, they were relatively small. So in the entire financial services industry, 80% of the assets were applying CECL this year. So the numbers can get a little skewed depending on which perspective you take, but I think most would look at just from a volume of assets. So the bulk of the industry applied CECL in this year, even though it was less than 400 banks in total.
Sue, did you want to add anything?
No, I think Hal covered it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. It's a little bit like here where Europe, for example, allowed a sort of a slower interaction with regulatory capital for the banks, and some people think that means IFRS 9 was deferred, but it's actually the regulatory interaction, so it's always complicated the banking space. Tadao.
Thank you. So it's a more philosophical question. As a standard setter, when we issue educational material, there is always the feeling that since it comes from the standard setter, despite we clearly say that's a non-mandatory guidance, it's more difficult when we do it and people can realize or think that this is the way to see, to look at the issue. And then as we are dealing with many countries applying IFRS, what we usually see, and we see, I believe that we see this in a very positive way, that many different national standard setters, the big audit firms, academics, they, in the end of the day, they start working with some educational material. My question is much more how much pressure there is for the FASB to not issue educational material or actually to issue educational material. Is it something that is more expected from the FASB point of view, or this is something that should be deal with more with the market?
Sure, let me find my mute button there. You know, I think from our perspective, it kind of depends, I think, based on our stakeholders, right? We have a very robust, you know, through the big four accounting firms, right? We have robust accounting literature that's out there that I think from larger preparers are pretty used to going and looking at those books and kind of comparing the different guides that are out there. But where I think we get a lot of the requests from an educational material perspective is from private companies, right, or smaller reporting entities. And, you know, and part of that can be from the standpoint of, you know, private company auditors may not necessarily have their own guides that are out there in the marketplace, or maybe hesitant to kind of point their clients to some of the other, you know, big four guides. Or it's even just the standpoint of, I think, trying to just kind of narrow it down to the issues that they're most concerned about in the current environment. So at least from my perspective, since I've kind of joined the FASB, you know, I would say that I don't think that we get, you know, the question of how much educational material, I think, is certainly, like you said, a philosophical question. I think that there are different perspectives on it, but I think what we're seeing it is really coming through more from the private company space and trying to be responsive, you know, when we feel like there's something that we can provide, you know, maybe more simplified understanding of GAAP. But what I want to be very clear on is when we've been issuing kind of our educational paper that we issued, it's just GAAP. There's nothing new or different in there. There's no real interpretation, right? It's really just trying to be like right in the middle of the fairway, but trying to provide, you know, pull together disparate pieces of GAAP together in a way that's more cohesive for someone who's maybe less sophisticated to be able to understand.
Thank you. Bruce.
Thanks, Sue. Mine was just more of a comment than anything. I mean, from my perspective, it's just interesting to see that both boards have done is almost the same. And I actually think that the standards have held up really well in practice. I mean, if you look at how companies have actually managed to apply it, people have got their reporting done. I mean, there have been a couple of challenges I came across. One of them was around some of the more developing nations, developing economies, where we've had more than one discussion with some of the regulators there around them wanting to delay certain things, or can we hold back on things like IFRS 9 because of the situation. To be honest, I think a lot of that was more around probably a bit more of a lack of understanding of what they actually meant by that, because I think when they actually got into unpacking it, they realized that wasn't really the solution. The other comment I was just going to make was that what I had seen in practice was this kind of where people ended up having some problems, it was more alluding to problems that they actually had with the application of the standards in the first place, and probably hadn't done that properly. The one I always hear from people, especially was around IFRS 9, where people outside of banking took the shortcut method in terms of raising their ECL provisions. Now, the problem with that was a lot of the companies turn around and said when IFRS 9 came out, well, we're just a simple trading company. What we've done historically is probably the best indicator of going forward, and they didn't really do much in amending their ECLs. Amending their provisions. When now they move to an ECL model, COVID kind of made them have to rethink that, because obviously your historical performance really wasn't an indicator of where you were going forward. So suddenly their models that they were using and hadn't really probably put enough effort into when they first applied them were suddenly called into question. So I don't think that's necessarily a shortcoming in the standard. I think it's more COVID highlighting, or the COVID crisis highlighting, where people had some challenges. So, but I mean, in my view, all in all, I actually think the standards and what we've done has held up well in practice.
Thanks, Bruce. Christine.
Thanks, Sue. So I have one comment and then one question for the IASB staff. So my comment just goes back to the discussion that we were having about the congressional deferral of CECL. And I just wanted to make the point that as we've been doing outreach to the users of financial statements, we've been hearing a lot of positive feedback from them regarding the information that they're getting from CECL, particularly during this period of difficulty, shall we say, and to the extent where I had one phone call that I was involved in with a user that had said that he was very strongly against CECL before it was issued, and now was a strong advocate for it because of the information that they were receiving to help them understand what banks felt, you know, what they believed about their ability to collect the balances that were owed to them. So I just provide that as background because I think one of the things that'll be interesting to watch is the extent to which there will be market pressure on those banks that chose not to go forward with CECL according to the effective date requirements, but took the congressional deferral, because I think they are probably going to be getting questions from their investors to help them understand information that they're not receiving as a result of the entity's decision to defer the application of CECL. So the question that I had was related to government grants. And so I guess this is for Javed and Neely. So one of the things that we've really struggled with is scoping. We've had a lot of discussions about whether or not it is possible to come up with an operable scope for disclosures related to government grants. And so my question is whether you hear a lot of concerns about the scope, whether it's too narrow or whether it's too broad, and if you have any advice for us in trying to come up with an operable scope for disclosure requirements related to government grants. Thank you.
And maybe Neely, I can start, but you can jump in. At least from my perspective and the time I've been here and working with the application questions that we get in for the interpretation committee and even through this period, there's not been particular questions that we've heard regarding the scope of IS-20. So for the most part, like from that perspective, I would say it seems to be holding up well. But maybe I'll ask Neely to see if there's anything that might have come up through the course of the agenda consultation regarding that.
Yeah, no, we haven't had anything come up on scope through the course of the agenda consultation. But I think, Javed, we can always take a look through our files and see if there's anything over the years that has come through. In fact, Hillary has. Yeah, Hillary's already reached out to us to connect on IS-20. So.
Yeah. Sue Cosper.
Thanks, Sam. This is really related back to the question that was posed earlier about, I'll call it the pressure to issue educational material or answer questions. And I think, you know, certainly, as I think about this question, I'm not sure that it's one that's specific to this current environment from the effects of the pandemic. I think that, you know, as we've seen through the, as we've come through the effective dates of some of these major standards, I think that, you know, because they're more principles-based, we certainly are getting questions, as you all know, you are too. But the ones that kind of resonate more is where we've eliminated this industry-specific guidance and the outcome has been different. And they are just struggling at times as to whether some of these outcomes are, you know, provide better information. And so, you know, I think that post-implementation reviews have been really helpful to surface some of those issues. I think at the end of the day, nobody wants to be second-guessed. You know, a COVID-related item that we continue to get questions on is this program that they have in the US called the Payroll Protection Program, and how do you account for it? And there's, you know, things that we have said in public meetings about the variety of options, so to speak, depending on the type of entity that you are and having to assess the facts and circumstances around it. And so I think it just boils down to people get uncomfortable with making judgments, making estimates, being second guessed. And, you know, so anything from an educational perspective that we can help guide them to form an opinion, I think is helpful.
Yeah, and I think that's been true on our side more generally. We actually had a panel at our recent conference, which Mary chaired, where we had a panel on how you make estimates and what's good, you know, good process and controls and good disclosure, and that's the important thing in this environment. But you can understand the challenges and people are afraid of getting the number wrong and then being criticised for it. So it's an understandable concern. The other thing, just prompted by Christine's observation about the usefulness of information around CECL, I think an ongoing sort of opportunity indirectly provided by COVID is going to be looking at the disclosures that have come out on the expected credit loss front for IFRS 9. So we recently decided not to start the impairment post-implementation review of IFRS 9 just yet. And one of the reasons for that is that we really want to have time to look at what the disclosures looked like, whether they worked for investors or not. And also, we know it's management's estimate, so we don't expect things to be directly comparable, but our objective was to have enough information that people were able to have a basis for making comparisons. And that's something we really want to understand more as time goes by, to see whether that's worked, what hasn't worked, both for the post-implementation review of NINE, but also our disclosure projects more generally, whether there's the way we're working on these objective-based disclosures is serving investors well, how can we write them better? So it's going to be a good source of information, I think. Did anybody else have anything before we wrap up the session on COVID-19? Don't think so. So thank you very much. It's good to see we've ended up doing quite similar things, which is great. Shall I hand over to you now, Rich, to move on to supply chain financing?